Conference record has joined the conference.
This important conversation that we're having. And I and Joe are looking right now at the epidemiology of medical malpractice, which I assume you're going to explain to us.
You mean it wasn't self-explanatory? yeah, I'll be happy to. One of the topics on the list of questions that was forwarded to me for today was something about access to the healthcare system, or to the medical liability system. And this slide is something that I use widely in talks to synthesize the available evidence on that point. So I can just sort of walk you through this in terms of understanding the relationship between the epidemiology of medical injury, you know, who gets injured in the hospital, and who gets into the medical malpractice system and takes money out of it. If you get hospitalized in the U.S., you have, on average, about a 3 or 4% chance of being injured by the care that you receive. You have about a 1% chance of being injured by negligent care. So we might think of those folks who are injured by negligent care, those people in the pink box there, as the group of people who have legitimate claims in the medical malpractice system. What we know from two major studies, the Harvard Medical Practice Study and the follow-on study that validated its results in another sample of claims in Utah and Colorado in the 1990s, is that about 2 to 3% of all of these folks will file claims, and about 5% of all of those who are seriously injured by negligence will file claims. So the major problem with the medical liability system from a scholar's perspective is not that there's too much litigation, it's that there's too little of it in comparison to the prevalence of medical injury. The difficulty, of course, is that layered on top of all of those meritorious claims is a bunch of claims that are of uncertain merit or no merit. And the respective proportions in those categories have varied across the studies. When we looked at this question in the Harvard Medical Practice Study, it appeared that for every one meritorious claim, there were about six non-meritorious claims. The follow-on study that we did here at Harvard a few years ago called the Malpractice Insurers Medical Error Prevention Study, or MIMEPS, which involved a more robust sample of claims, changed our thinking upon that quite a bit. I think the best available evidence today is what you see here, and that is about 44% of those claims are what we call valid, meaning that when experts reviewed all of the evidence that was available at the end of the malpractice litigation, meaning everything that the defense insurer had in its possession as well as the underlying medical record, they found evidence of both a medical error and a cognizable injury in 44% of the cases that were clearly valid. In another 30% of cases, the ones that I've labeled frivolous here with quotation marks around that term because I know that is a loaded term, there was fairly clearly not evidence that an error had occurred. In most cases, there was evidence of an injury, but not of, of error or negligence. And in the middle are another 26% of cases where even at the conclusion of the claims, the expert reviewers said, you know, this is really kind of a close call. You know, I'll call it on one side or the other of the 50-50 mark, but I still feel pretty uncertain about the merit of this claim. So the message in this set of bars here is that it's a complex picture in terms of what's in the medical malpractice system. It's not predominantly clogged with what lawyers would consider frivolous claims, meaning that there's no reasonable basis for bringing that claim. And indeed, even at the end of the litigation where we have experts looking at everything that was available, in many, many cases, it's still really hard to call it. And that finding has real implications for thinking about what kind of reforms would be helpful for screening out non-meritorious litigation, because it tells us that there may not be enough known at the outset of litigation to do a really good job of that. Finally, the last set of bars here with the dollar signs says something about who takes money out of the system. And the good news here is that if you've got a valid claim, your chances of taking money out are very, very much higher than if your claim is of uncertain merit or no merit. The bad news is that in about a quarter of the cases, the results are discordant with the merit of the claim, meaning that it was what we'd consider a non-meritorious claim. There was no evidence of negligence, but there was still a payment made. Or in an even larger pool of cases, there was evidence of negligence, but the plaintiff recovered no money. So the headline here really varies depending on who you talk to. When we published that finding, the American Medical Association issued a press release saying, medical liability system is broken. 1 in 4 cases are resolved, discordantly with its merit. And the American Bar Association issued a press release saying medical liability system works great. 3 in 4 cases are resolved correctly. So that's kind of a glass half full, glass half empty finding in terms of the performance of the liability system. But overall, I think this shows there's a substantial disconnect between the folks who are entitled to compensation under the rules that we've set up in this system and those who end up taking money out of the system. And I think that I've highlighted some specific areas where reforms are or not likely to be helpful in ameliorating that problem.
Okay, that's now you clarified this tutorial. Any questions?
Yeah,
I have a question. When you qualify a claim as either having merit or not having merit, are you talking about each lawsuit being a separate claim, or is it each individual who's named in the lawsuit being a separate claim?
That's a good question. In this study, a claim was defined as a written demand for payment, so it was broader than just lawsuits. There were some cases that we included that never progressed to litigation, but that involved a letter from a plaintiff's attorney demanding money. And we use PACE, not the defendant, as the unit of analysis.
Okay. Anything else? Any other thoughts on this? I see no additional questions are being rendered here, Michelle. We thank you very much for this. So this is a finding that is sobering, right? But I can understand how you can look at it a lot of different ways. This is Chris Meyer speaking.
Michelle Hyde, you may not be able to know this, but how is this compared to other types of litigation? Like, is 44% a good number compared to...
That's also a really good question, and the simple answer is we don't know. These kinds of studies of the civil justice system are extremely difficult to do, and to my knowledge, there isn't a comparable study done in any other area of the U.S. civil justice system that would enable us to draw good comparisons like that. And one of the reasons it is difficult to do this is that, as you know, publicly reported data on case outcomes just aren't available to really get this granular level of detail. What you have to do is go to the liability insurers and have them open up their files, which is a very expensive and difficult thing to do.
All right, thank you.
Okay, anything else? Joe?
Yes, this is Art Fugner. I do have one question. Why do you think this disconnect exists, those who are compensated versus those who are entitled?
So I think there are lots of reasons, and there are like three different disconnects here. The first question is, why don't more people sue? And the practicing attorneys around the table can answer that question perhaps better than I can, because they see the great reserve of people who seek legal representation but don't end up filing claims. But my understanding is that there are some of the reasons that people don't manage to obtain legal representation is that their cases either are not valued highly enough or appear to have difficulties of proof that would preclude bringing it to a successful conclusion and therefore are not going to win the investment of an attorney working on a contingent fee system. Another reason people may not claim and indeed may not even present at attorney's offices is that they may be unaware that they've suffered a medical injury, particularly since the traditional approach to responding to medical injuries has been deny and defend. It's very probable that some people believe adverse outcomes of medical care were not due to preventable circumstances. And so, you know, what are the remedies around that disconnect? I think certainly more open disclosure of medical errors, such as we've been striving for in the New York Demonstration Project, is critical to getting patients to understand their entitlement to compensation. And then thinking about, in my opinion, alternative models of compensation that would allow patients with small value claims to access the system and receive an expeditious settlement, perhaps without a significant investment on the part of a plaintiff's attorney, would be critical to improving access to justice. Thinking about what's responsible for frivolous claims being in the system, my hypothesis here is that it's simply lack of information. I don't believe many plaintiff's attorneys act in bad faith in bringing claims, particularly since they have a personal financial investment on the line. They have an interest in getting things right, and the question is how do we get information to people at an early stage so that they can make better informed decisions about what is a meritorious claim. And here again, I think processes that improve transparency and discussion at the early stage of medical injury resolution are really critical. Medical screening panels, things of that nature, tend not to work because they depend on the information that the litigants have in their possession. They don't increase that information. And often, as I pointed out with these study results, that information just isn't enough. The final disconnect is taking money out of the system. And here, you know, that there are familiar arguments about whether juries are qualified to adjudicate these kinds of cases correctly. The probability of getting it wrong increases when one goes to trial. Interestingly, though, it increases in the opposite direction of what people think. Most people think juries are really great for plaintiffs. The reality is that in the studies that we've done here, plaintiffs are losing 4 out of 5 trials, and they're often losing even when they have meritorious claims. So it's really the settlement process that we need to hone in on. And trying to understand, you know, how these settlements go awry, what leads people to settle in cases that are not meritorious, and what defeats efforts to settle cases that are meritorious. That, to me, is the most mysterious, why plaintiffs who have a good case cannot manage to get a settlement.
Well, I must say, for a single slide, this has a lot of information in it.
It's 30 years of toil by those of us.
Anything else?
You know, I was asked to speak about a couple other points, and I'd be happy to do that, but just at the request of the committee. If you're ready to move on, that's fine, too.
Yeah, go ahead.
Go ahead, please. It would be our pleasure to listen to you.
Well, one question was about the impact of liability costs on medical care costs, and that's an area that I've spent a fair amount of time studying. So we're talking here about defensive medicine costs. Let me just share a little bit of data on that point. It's a hotly contested point, to put it bluntly, with lots of studies sort of clouding the information space that are of dubious quality or uncertain quality because the methodology is not transparent. Even the best that we have in this area, frankly, are unsatisfactory. The best way to try to understand the effect of defensive medicine on healthcare costs is to study variation across different areas of high and low liability risk. But that's really only been done for the most part for a small number of medical conditions. So when you hear numbers bandied about, including those in the Excellus report, which was based on the study that my team did here in Harvard, it's important to understand that those numbers are based on good studies, but they're studies that are very narrowly focused, and then they're big extrapolations from looking at just a small number of different kinds of care. With those caveats, the best information that we have is that defensive medicine costs account for about 80% of the total cost of the medical liability system and are somewhere in the region of $45 billion a year. So that's a lot of money. In the context of total health expenditures, it's not a lot of money. It's just a couple of percent of our total national health care spending bill. But in absolute terms, that's a lot that we're paying every year for the indirect cost of medical liability. I want to call your attention to another paper that came out last year that not many folks have read by Bill Thomas and some colleagues the University of Southern Maine, which is one of the few papers to drill down on particular specialties. They got access to a bunch of claims from Cigna, the big health insurer, and were able to look at how common defensive medicine was across different clinical areas. They found that the specialties with the greatest percentage of episodes of care that involved evidence of defensive medicine were, in descending order, pediatrics, allergy and immunology, dermatology, family practice, internal medicine, plastic surgery, and infectious disease. I found those results interesting because those aren't the specialties that we hear from the most about concerns about medical liability. But when you actually look at the billing and look at, you know, where does billing seem to be responsive to medical malpractice premiums going up, it's disproportionately in those specialties. It's important to note, though, that although the authors found it was quite common in these specialties to see this kind of defensive medicine reaction, the overall cost burden they estimated to be small. To put a fine point on it, they felt that if medical malpractice insurance premiums were to be reduced 10%, the reduction in healthcare spending across all specialties would be less than 1%, considerably less than 1%, about 1/10 or 1/8 of 1%. So they conclude defensive medicine practices exist and are widespread, but their impact on medical care costs is small. And in ongoing work that I'm sure you could get access to if you're interested, they're actually looking at which types of services within each of these specialties account for defensive medicine costs.
This is Ken Rafke speaking. I'm glad you brought those that study to our attention.
If you've got just a couple more minutes, I'll tell you about one other topic, which is which types of adverse events contribute most significantly to high medical malpractice costs.
Absolutely.
I think I gave you a paper that answered the more general question of who pays for the cost of preventable medical injuries. But it's a different question to ask specifically what shows up in medical malpractice claims. You're in a great position in New York to be able to answer that question with New York-specific data because you do have the closed claims database. So I'd refer you to that as absolutely the best source of information about what the most costly kinds of claims are. But there are a few academic papers that have come out in the last year that might be helpful to you to look at. One came out in the New England Journal of Medicine earlier this year. It was a study of closed claims data over a 15-year period from a large national physician insurer. And it found that the highest risk specialties in terms of the percentage of physicians who experienced the claim annually were essentially all surgical specialties, including OB-GYN. In each of these specialties, the physicians had greater than a 10% chance of being sued every year. But interestingly, these weren't the same specialties that had the highest claim payouts per year. So if you're looking at what the most costly specialties are to an insurer, they were pediatrics at the top by a long shot, and then OB-GYN, neurosurgery, pathology, internal medicine, pulmonary medicine, and cardiology. And OB-GYN had the greatest number of very large payments, over $1 million, followed by pathology, anesthesiology, and pediatrics. Finally, I mentioned a study that just came out in the Journal of the American Medical Association by Bishop and colleagues. They looked at national data from the National Practitioner Data Bank over a 5-year period, and essentially looked at the mix of inpatient and outpatient claims. And that's important because most of the information we have about medical injuries and malpractice comes from the hospital setting. We, in the scholarly literature, we know relatively little about the outpatient setting. In the outpatient setting, they found by far the most costly types of claims were diagnostic-related claims, missed and delayed diagnoses, followed by treatment-related claims and then surgical claims. Not surprisingly, in the inpatient claims, the most common types of adverse events represented were surgical. That was about 34% of the claims. 21% were missed and delayed diagnoses, and the remaining 20% were treatment-related, mostly medication errors. Obstetric and anesthesia-related errors were less common, which is a bit of a surprise. So, you know, that's basically the best evidence we have from the academic literature about what's represented in claims. It's a thin evidence base. And so, again, if you really want great information about what's impacting things in New York, I think you need to go back to the insurance department and get somebody to look to pull some things out of your own closed claims database, which I've spent some time looking through and is really a terrific resource.
Well, thank you for that summary. Any questions? Yes.
Hi, this is Nick Lepine. Just clarification. You mentioned some percentages, and I wasn't clear the context in which you were giving those percentages. For example, you mentioned 80% of of some of the liability costs? I wasn't clear on what you were referring to.
I think I was talking about defensive medicine with the 80% figure. We looked at what the medical liability system costs the country in total and found that about 20% of its costs are direct costs, meaning the cost of running insurance companies, litigating cases, and giving money to plaintiffs. The remaining 80% of the social costs come in the form of defensive medicine, and they total about $45 billion a year.
Michelle, this is Ken Rasky. We had a really wild range that was presented earlier, anywhere between $25 billion and $210
billion. Yep.
And so you're narrowing it down and putting a peg on it at $45 billion.
So. That's my estimate. So we wrote this paper because I was getting tired of having the same conversation with journalists and staffers over and over again. What the cost of defensive medicine?
Well,
so we finally did our sort of last and best analysis of that, that was published by myself and an economist from Harvard and another a couple of scholars, Atul Gawande and David Sutter here from the Harvard School of Public Health. And so we looked across all of the available estimates of defensive medicine, the methodologies of those studies, and really fixed on a series of studies by two scholars, Dan Kessler and Mark McClellan, as absolutely the best available estimates. And our estimates are based on those. If you look carefully at some of the larger numbers, you'll see they're coming from studies that either don't disclose their methods at all, that claim to synthesize other papers without saying how they've done it, or that extrapolate numbers from physician surveys, and physicians have every reason in the world to over-report their defensive medicine practice or to be unable to extricate the respective roles of liability pressure and other pressures like financial reimbursement from their decisions to order extra services. So I don't consider any of those studies to be as robust as the ones that we used.
Okay, we have Fred Hyde. And then Art Levin, and then, of course,
Professor, there are a couple of papers in Health Affairs last September. Maybe you've been alluding to these. One contends, this is the Carrier-Rushovsky paper, of which you were a co-author, contends that physicians' fears of being sued are not removed, are not assuaged by tort reform. In other words, that you couldn't expect a lot of behavior change. The other paper, the Thomas Ziller Thayer paper, also contends small savings from tort reform, low cost of defensive medicine. Is there anything more recent or, in your view, better, more definitive? Because this defensive medicine thing is such a tricky business. People ask me, well, what would you have doctors do? It's the standard, whatever the standard is. If they're not going to practice according to the standard, what are they doing? It's a tricky concept, and I'm wondering if you've seen anyone who's managed, or perhaps you have managed to define it somewhat more precisely so that we could measure whether or not anything happens to it.
Yeah, I mean, it's the slipperiest topic in this area of research. And the short answer is no, there's certainly nothing more recent. You know, these studies are only a year old or less at this. And I don't believe there is or will be anything better. The problem is not in the definition. People can agree on a definition. The problem is in the measures. There are basically only two ways to measure this. One, you can ask doctors, how often do you practice defensive medicine? And you can bootstrap your estimates based on that. And I've talked about the problem with self-reporting already, that it's just not a reliable indicator. And one of the reasons is that physicians are just so stressed by liability that they'll say, oh, this is something that I always do. And in reality, there are probably a number of different forces pushing them in the direction of overutilization. It's very difficult to separate out those forces. The other thing you can do is try to control for those other things and then examine differences in the rates of utilization of different services in different geographic areas. So I can look at, across the 50 states, I can use some malpractice premiums or some other measure to control for ways in which the liability environment differs. And I can also control for things like differences in reimbursement rate and see how much of the variation in imaging or cesarean section seems to be linked to that liability pressure. That's the better method. That's the method that the best studies have relied on. Actually those studies are not super far apart in their estimates of the impact. They're all kind of vaguely converging on something around 2% of national healthcare spending. But then there's a sort of meta debate that goes on about whether that is a lot or a little. because it's a lot in one respect, in the respect that $45, $50 billion is a lot of money to be spending each year. And it's a little in the sense that, you know, if you want to look at the top five ways to reduce healthcare costs, there's probably a lot of other things in line ahead of medical liability because there's so many things that are contributing to inflationary pressure in healthcare expenses.
Art doesn't have a question.
Hi, this is Joe Bellick, one of the co-chairs. I had two questions I wanted to ask. On your slide where you say frivolous claims, are you referring to claims or individual cases?
So claims in the sense that they are both lawsuits and other written demands for payments, but cases in the sense that we did not count it as two if there were two defendants.
Okay. And have you had the opportunity to study at any point how much Medicaid programs save by having costs of medical errors compensated through the tort system?
No. I can think of how you would do that.
Could you outline for us how you would do that? Because that would be a recommendation that the committee could look at is what the savings are to Medicaid through tort system compensation. So if you have thoughts on that, we'd love to hear them.
So, I mean, one thought is, as you know, there's already a subrogation process in place through which Medicaid can seek reimbursement when a incident of medical care that has created Medicaid expenses is deemed to be due to the negligence of a provider. They can try to get that money back. And so you could go to CMS or the state Medicaid program and see what their practices are around that. Some states, I think, are really vigorous in going after that money, and others are not. But it'll give you a sense of what they've saved so far through that subrogation rule. The other thing you could try to do is look in your closed claims database. I believe there is at least a field for the insurance status of the patient. I don't think it's consistently filled in. But you could look in there and see you know, how much has been paid to patients who are Medicaid eligible. And you could, from there, get a sense of what Medicaid might be able to save, either through more aggressive subrogation or being a secondary payer in some other way.
We have Dr. Goldman.
Michelle Lee Goldman. Would you be able, to calculate for us a number for New York based on where we stand in terms of our malpractice premiums and our Medicaid and overall costs?
What kind of number?
Well, the $45 billion, 2% for the U.S.
No, I don't have – it's not based on state-specific estimates. It's extrapolated from a number of national estimates of cost components.
Okay, so you wouldn't be possible for your methodology to do it just for New York State?
No, but again, because you have your own closed claims database, you could get it that way.
Okay, thank you.
He flagged it off.
Okay.
Michelle, this is Nick Opinion. Would there be any way, and you mentioned the way to look at the records to find out what savings there have been as a result of Medicaid recoupment of liens. But another aspect, would it be possible to look and see what Medicaid saves as a result of Medicaid patients going off Medicaid as a result of self? In other words, a Medicaid patient, up until the time of the settlement, is obviously a liability of Medicaid, but if and when they receive monies, they go off Medicaid to the extent that they are no longer Medicaid eligible. And
does that really occur? I've never thought about this before.
Yes. Sometimes there will be a supplemental needs trust where they'll stay on Medicaid, but in many instances, if the award is or the settlement is large enough, and depending upon the claimant,
and they're over the asset limit.
Not everybody will go the SNT, we call it, route. They'll just choose to get the money themselves, have control over it, and as a consequence, they go off Medicaid.
Huh.
And I was just wondering if there was any way to study what the Medicaid savings may be in that regard.
I think Judge McKeon will want to.
No, I'll let Nick get his answer first, and I'll.
Okay.
It's an interesting question. Again, I've never thought about it. I mean, it strikes me that you have records of whose eligibility changes. You have records of who is the claimant in these closed claims, because I think the patient's name is generally filled in. So you could match those up. It'd take a lot of work. then you know who's going off. But the next step is how much would they cost Medicaid? That's harder. You can try to look at their past utilization and make some projections into the future, but that would really give you only the crudest indication because people's medical spending from year to year, in most cases, is not very stable. There's a lot of variation, and, of course, they'd be aging over time. So it would be an extremely complicated set of calculations and merging of data sets, I would think.
Well, I only point out this Alborn decision from the United States Supreme Court significantly circumscribes how much Medicaid can recover as far as a past lien is concerned from a recovery. So that would have to be factored in as well.
Okay.
Joel Glass has a question.
One answer to the question. You're only dealing with future. Most future Medicaid expenses are in the obstetrical area, and the medical indemnity fund removes them from the equation, so there's very little, if any, Medicaid savings through the tort system because the liens are payable from the defendants, we pay those anyway. And even if there was a savings, the cost is passed on to the provider. So it goes into your hospital-based expenses, and then it goes into your malpractice premiums for your doctors. So I don't think that that's a worthwhile path to pursue.
That's a good comment. Anything else? Yes, Justin.
Mr. Glass, just jog by memory on something, Laura. Can we get some clarity, because it's been asked of me. Assume a youngster in the medical indemnity fund develops cancer, having nothing to do with obstetrical injuries. Will the fund pay those medical expenses?
Yes.
Yep, the answer is yes.
Yes.
All
yes.
Medical
the answer is cool. Yes. Okay, Michelle, thank you so much. You've been terrific in enlightenment, and we've got a lot to mull over. So I appreciate your time.
No problem. Best of luck.
Okay, thank you. Luck is a variable.
No. Yeah, you don't.
Yeah, Laura, can we get that?
I will make sure I circulate all of this information. It just was coming in pretty fast and furious. Yeah. No, I'm sorry.
No, I didn't see it either.
No,
so thank you. Okay, we're going to go on the home stretch here with three presentations by Art Levin, Lorraine Ryan, and Dr. Kleinman. And we're going to begin with Arthur Levin, who I believe you have to leave at 3:30 anyways, right?
I'm assuming we're still heading for a 3:30 or thereabouts landing. I'm going to cut my remarks.
Well, I think 4 o'clock we were scheduled
okay.
for. So
as you know, I have a 3:30 cut point. So anyway, sort of in turning to the cost of adverse events and the subset of those adverse events, which we call medical error, I think we have some of the same evidence problems that we talked about in this morning and before lunch. Although I think in this area we have some evidence through peer-reviewed studies and reports from government agencies that do begin to offer an independent assessment of the incidents and estimates of related costs. I think you should know that I was part of the IOM committee that wrote to Errors Human, and I would be less than frank to say that 11, 12 years later, I am frustrated and disappointed with the lack of progress that we seem to have made overall in improving patient safety. I would be less than honest not to acknowledge that professionals and providers and associations like Greater New York to my right have been working very hard during this time to make patient safety an important focus and to make it less likely that a patient entering a hospital will have an adverse event or, again, that subset, a preventable medical error. An example of the focus in New York and of the Greater New York's and Haney's role was that the hospital associations joined with me in crafting and passing legislation to publicly report what we call then hospital-acquired infections, or HAIs. And those reports have been promising, showing that there can be improvement when there's focus. It's been, frankly, frustrating that maintaining improvement and spreading improvement is proving to be a difficult task. So what we've had in the last year and a half or so is the publication of several studies and a report from that was mentioned earlier from the Office of the Inspector General of HHS that suggests that we really cannot be confident that a patient entering a hospital in the United States is any safer today than they were 11 or 12 years ago. And I think that's sobering, because we are talking a lot about incorporating what we know about sort of approaches to improving patient safety into a lot of the work that we do. And while all of that is promising, there seems to be some intractability to making significant improvements across the board. And I think that's not to assign blame, because, again, people are working very hard and diligently to make things better. But it's to suggest that we really don't yet understand fully how to bring about the change that we need. And this may be a much longer road to travel than we thought in 1999 or 5 years ago or even today. So the question is, how much should we rely on patient safety efforts to really make a difference? And I think that's a question that's hard to answer. In terms of the cost of adverse events and medical errors, we know that over the last 5 years there's been a lot of attention focused on infections nationally as well as in New York. And thanks to the CDC, we do have some evidence-supported estimates of the cost of these infections, again, with this very wide-range phenomenon. So depending on whether you assume a preventability level of 70% or 50% or 20%, you come out with these ranges of numbers. The CDC estimates the low value, that is where there's the assumption is that 20% of the infections are preventable, that the cost is between $5.7 and $6.8 billion annually. That's across the country. And then at the high end, where the assumption is that 70% of these infections are preventable, the value is $25 to $31.5 billion. This is just for infections. Now, when CDC compares these costs with our estimates of the cost for the three principal diagnoses nationally that have the highest annual aggregate inpatient cost, and this is in $2006, coronary artery disease is $17.5 billion, MIs are $11.8 billion, and congestive heart failure a little over 11 days. While these are national data, it seems to me it should not be hard to figure out how to extrapolate and come up with some estimates for what this means for New York and for New York Medicaid. Again, trying to get a handle in an area of sparse evidence on the cost, I spoke to a colleague and friend at the Harvard School of Public Health, and he provided some conservative estimates. These are based on work that he and other patient safety experts have done, other studies. And what he told me as a conservative estimate is for preventable adverse events, and this is beyond all adverse events, not just medical errors, an estimated cost, not including any cost to the patient suffering the injury, is thought to be about $22 billion in 2010 dollars, with a range of 18 to 28 billion, again, very dramatic range of estimate. For all adverse events in hospitals, I'm sorry, let me go back. For the preventable adverse events in hospitals, that is medical errors or negligent events, it's the $22 billion estimate on average and the range of 18 to 28. For all adverse events in hospitals, an estimate of $43.5 billion with a range from 32 to over $56 billion. And there are other studies around that sort of come in the same ballpark. The disappointing or the glass half empty news is that a November 2010 report from the Inspector General found that one in seven Medicare beneficiaries discharged from hospitals in 2008 experienced an adverse event. And the Office of the Inspector General estimates that during the month of October, they looked at that month specifically, the cost of both adverse events and temporary harm, which is not categorized as an adverse event, was estimated to be $324 million. And they annualized the cost to Medicare of $4.4 billion, or 3.5% of Medicare inpatient expenditures. Two other recent studies cast doubt on whether we've made any demonstrable progress in reducing preventable harm due to medical errors. One was published in the New England Journal in November, where Clausen et al. Looked at 10 North Carolina hospitals, chosen because they were thought to be particularly focus on reducing patient harm through adverse events, and found that 18% of their patients, almost one in five, were harmed by their medical care, and more than 60% of that harm was judged to be preventable. And last, an April 2011 article in Health Affairs described the use of a new tool for finding adverse events in hospitals developed by the Institute of Healthcare Improvement. And the study authors believed that the use of that tool produced data that indicated that adverse events are considerably underreported in voluntary reporting and even in ARC's patient safety indicator methodology that many people are using to identify patient safety events. So I think what we know is that we have a long road to travel, as I said, that we have no assurance that despite all of this effort, that we've been able to sort of climb the mountain and get over to the other side and to be able to assure patients in New York or anywhere else that they are indeed safer when going into a hospital today than they were a decade ago. As we all know, any prerequisite for quality and safety improvement is to create valid and reliable measures of patient safety performance and to track them over time. Now, New York State does not have a medical error database. It has a hospital incident reporting database, and really an adverse event reporting database. And that system, and I don't know if my colleagues from Greater New York will agree, has sort of become dysfunctional. It is a system that was put in place in 1985, in the 1985 medical malpractice crisis. It has been had three different iterations and designs. The last one, Lorraine Ryan and I were on the work group. We thought we'd done a pretty good job. But despite that, the system has really wound down into this dysfunctional state. And part of the problem is that, frankly, the state has never devoted the resources to this effort, to this collection of data, that it needs. Even in the heyday of NIPORTS, the senior staff did not have NIPORTS as their primary responsibility. They had lots of other responsibilities within the department, and the only dedicated staff were sort of at the data collection and clerical end. And that sent the message to, I think, those of us on the committee that this was really not taken very seriously by the state. And this has been true for decades. It's not just talking about the status today. So I think one of the things to think about, because there are cross-cutting issues across all these work groups, is whether it would be appropriate for this work group to make a recommendation that directs the department to develop and refine and the state to adequately fund data reporting requirements that track adverse events and medical errors for the purpose of quality improvement and safety improvement. I think our hospital-acquired infection public reporting efforts can perhaps serve as a model. Well, let me give you a comparison. Those efforts are funded by federal dollars from CDC. That effort, which is focused on one kind of adverse event, has a staff, full-time devoted staff, that is, well, it has 10 people or so devoted entirely to that effort. NIPORTS never had 10 analysts and experts devoted entirely to reporting of adverse events across the entire system. One thing that is critical is that whatever effort goes forward, it has to have the analytic capacity to make the data useful for providers, professionals to use in quality and safety improvement efforts, for the state as a payer and a regulator to make prudent decisions and policies, and for the public at large to be able to understand what their risks are when they have an encounter with the healthcare system. It seems to me that if the state can come up with a scheme to fund a medical indemnity fund to the tune of tens of millions of dollars annually, wouldn't it make better sense to fund patient safety efforts to the same degree? And last but not least, I'd like to suggest that the state has a fiduciary responsibility to spend the taxpayers' money wisely. Paying for unsafe, substandard medical care is not prudent by any stretch of the imagination. It is public dollars, state, federal, and county, that fund the largest share of healthcare costs. So the last recommendation might be that the state re-envision itself, and I think it's doing this in Medicaid, as a prudent purchaser, and continue at an accelerated pace to explore and develop various approaches to reimbursement based on performance, especially in the realm of patient safety. Sadly, I think what we've discovered is that money does talk, and that reimbursement can be either a barrier or help us advance safety and quality efforts. So while eliminating all preventable harm may be a daunting task, I don't think that difficulty justifies us paying for harm with public dollars.
Thank you, Art. You have covered a large number of issues, and some I would probably argue with you as being a little harsh in your judgments, but those are your judgments. Any questions? Okay. Thank you.
Thank you.
We have Lorraine Ryan, Senior Vice President of Legal, Regulatory, and Professional Affairs with Greater New York Hospital Association. Lorraine?
Thank you. And I do want to say comments.
Lorraine, it's hard to hear you here. I don't know if that thing is on.
Is this on now?
Yeah. Now you're on. Uh-huh.
I just want to address some of what Art said. We have been at the table, and I think you can go to my third slide on Nyport. Together on Nyport since, I hate to say how long, like the late 90s, I think.
We were children.
We were children. and the state's interest is truly in patient safety and improving outcomes, but there is a funding issue, and I think we really need to take that into account as this new Quality Institute and initiative gets underway to appropriately be able to analyze and derive from this wealth of data. Reporting is certainly not perfect, but there's a tremendous effort that is made by institutions to get a lot more information out of that system. Just to also address the other context that Art put this whole advanced reporting world in place, if you go to the next slide, Laura. CMS has also been looking from a public reporting as well as a pay-for-performance standpoint, what is happening with regard to ERA. If you could just advance the slide.
Laura, could you move to the next slide?
Sorry. And since 2003, I'm sure you're all well aware that on Hospital Compare, a significant amount of information is detailed with regard to process, and process, as we know, influences outcome. With the goal to improve performance and inform consumer healthcare decisions, over time, this database has expanded and has evolved into a pay-for-reporting system. And not only do we now have healthcare-acquired conditions or HACs for Medicare, but they also exist for Medicaid, and I'll show you in a minute how they line up. In addition to that, coming soon in 2013, we have value-based purchasing, which, again, takes many of these complications and conditions, and through a formula that's calculated for each individual institution, will penalize hospitals that are not meeting certain expectations. On top of this, we had readmission penalties at both the Medicare and the Medicaid level. This is just an example, or just gives you a picture of where we are today with regards to, next slide, sorry, the measures and the many different programs that really can influence provider reimbursement. So truly, we are not in the future going to be compensated as providers for providing care to patients where any one of a number of occurrences, adverse events in some cases, not always preventable in all cases, takes place. I just want to put the adverse event reporting world in the context also of a recent study by the GAO, recent 2008. The drawbacks and the imperfections that we suffer from in New York State with regard to Nyport is not unique to New York. The incidence of events and the ability to measure those events, even in a mandatory system, is tremendously difficult because we are dependent upon communication among providers and identification and interpretation of what is an adverse event. So the impact of non-payment policies may actually offer some greater push in the direction of getting more robust reporting. Underreporting, though it exists, is not what you need in all cases to really improve outcomes. And there have been many studies that demonstrate that you can learn from one or, you know, fewer than every event in a given category of care in terms of what you need to do to improve. And again, we know that public reporting and transparency drives improvement, and public reporting is here to stay. Some of the strategies that came out of the report are those very same strategies that Greater New York has implemented in many of its programs. I just want to go through them quickly. but more rapid and routine adoption of recommended best practices. The best practices are out there. It's a matter of implementation. Data collection and standardizing definitions so that we're all measuring the same thing, that we can benchmark against national measures and not against individual institutions, is really important. And expanding the use of electronic health records, we know, is at the core of a lot of improvements that will be sustainable and meaningful in the future. If you could go to the next slide. As I mentioned, and now I'd like to get really at the core and the heart and soul of what I'm here to talk about, is what can we do to really improve? What is actionable? What is operational? What can we operationalize? What is sustainable? And what, you know, transcends any type of institution with regard to resources? And Greater New York believes through its collaborative improvement model that we are both addressing public policy and all the recommendations that have come out of both the GAO reports and other studies that tell us what really drives improvement is decreasing variation and adopting evidence-based standards. Providing clinical expertise to help institutions, again, with varying resources, operationalize these solutions. It requires a significant organizational commitment to improvement. We talked a lot about culture. We've heard about culture. It takes a lot to really change culture, but I think both the government and individual institutions and payers and malpractice insurance carriers are really putting a full-court press on us to really devote the time and attention it needs to move from a captain-of-the-team-only mentality to a real team effort to improvement and to provide safe and effective care. One way of doing this is adopting a bundle of evidence-based practices. Again, the evidence tells us what we need to do in each and every discipline. That creates significant challenges. OB is a prime example of that. There are evidence-based practices out there. The IHI has developed what's called an idealized perinatal safety bundle. That is the heart and soul of the Greater New York Collaborative, which I'll get to in a minute in detail. But for other specialties of care and other disease management programs, there are evidence-based practices that can drive best outcomes. Institutional resources vary tremendously. I've heard a lot of questioning today, you know, why? Why is it different? Why aren't we improving? We know what we need to do, but we don't always have the resources that we need to get there. And that is a significant issue that I think not only this committee, but it transcends all of the Medicaid redesign work in terms of how to really resource appropriately. We spend a lot of time penalizing the poor performers or the bad providers, if you will, but we don't spend a lot of time incenting those who have the least to do the right thing. So I think we need to look at a different model and shift the paradigm in terms of how we actually treat institutions, if you will, in their efforts. Data, as we know, will drive improvement and will also help us measure and score what is making a difference. And sharing these successful strategies, it's also been key to not only our collaborative, but many of the collaboratives that we have learned from. Move to the next slide. Thank you. We talked a lot about obstetrics, and across the country, targeting these malpractice drivers have been these perinatal safety interventions. These are the interventions that have had tremendous success. Team training, we've talked a lot about it today. Standardizing ESM interpretation, and really requiring proficiency across the board in terms of provider and clinician being able to really appropriately manage and treat patients. It's not just you're licensed and registered once and deemed proficient for life, but really testing and ensuring that clinicians are proficient in their discipline. We're learning a lot through simulation. We're learning a lot about how to train our staff and how to educate our staff. We've moved away from the paper policy and procedures and the re-education mode that we used to be in, and we're really teaching people the skills necessary to take care of patients in 2011 and beyond. The technical needs are tremendously demanding, and it's not only what you learned in medical school or nursing school or any of our subspecialty and ancillary departments that will get you through. We really need to continuously train and retrain, and the use of simulation is a really valuable tool. Again, getting at the culture, what do the staff think? What do the patients think? Very important question that was raised this morning. And many institutions are asking their patients, and they, not only because they're required to for HCAHPS and other experience of care surveys, but really how safe do you feel in this institution? And they ask, by asking staff how safe they feel, you also ask them, would you want to be treated in this institution? And this is really important feedback for the leader of an organization that may think one thing is going on at a certain level in terms of performance, but can learn something very different from staff once they're asked in a safe and anonymous manner. Peer review and anonymous event reporting to, again, drive improvement and transparency is critical. On the next slide, it's just an example, if you will, of some of the successful interventions in the area of perinatal safety, many of which we are emulating in our own collaborative, but some of which are right next door in our HHC facility in the Bronx. Both Jacoby and North Central Bronx have demonstrated significant improvement in avoiding injuries or palsies from shoulder dystocias while not increasing their C-section rate. So they're getting away from the defensive medicine costs that a C-section would bring to an institution, at the same time delivering in a much safer manner babies that otherwise could suffer a shoulder dystocia and an herbs palsy injury. North Shore LIJ has also demonstrated some real improvement just through their team training, adoption of culture of safety, simulation training, and so on and so forth. So we know we can do it. Our peers are doing it. It's just how do we take it further? And that's the role that Greater New York has tried to fill in the area of perinatal safety. Currently, we have 44 hospitals that have actively engaged with this collaborative and will continue to do so through Greater New York and possibly through an endeavor that CMS has actually put out there that I'll talk about in a moment. Again, the goal of the collaborative is simply to reduce adverse events and injury by implementing these standardized protocols, widespread dissemination, empowering frontline staff to initiate early interventions. Escalation policies are key. One of the things that we, or one of the unfortunate things we often see, and less often, I hope, today than we did many years ago, was a failure of a case to get escalated to the up the chain of command when appropriate intervention was needed. You know, the junior intern that didn't know enough to call for help. And right now, that intern and those residents are supported in a way that they don't have to call for help. Help is there. 24-hour coverage of labor and delivery units is much more the standard of care today than it ever was in the past. Sustainability is always a factor. Art talked about it, and it's always something that we have great concerns about. But this is a challenge that we hope to meet by really creating leadership that truly believe in these kind of approaches. This is just a schematic that tells you, again, what it takes to arrive at a safer point with regard to perinatal care from both a safety climate standpoint, what are all those processes that you can put in place, as well as what are the clinical protocols that really need to be the standard of care. In addition to perinatal safety, let me just talk very quickly about some of what we think our results demonstrate. We've seen widespread adoption of these practices. We see hospitals scoring well above the national average on a safety climate survey. We see effective and sustainable EFM training programs and certification being required in certain institutions where doctors and nurses are learning together so that they can communicate in the same language. And there have been, as I mentioned, several institutional successes. But we need to go further. Can I tell you today that this is going to lead to a reduction in severity and frequency? I certainly believe so, but we don't have that evidence at this point. Some of those other institutions across the country that have been at it longer than we have can demonstrate those successes, and that's where we want to be headed, where we are headed, and where we want to end up a few years from now. We've applied the same model to other high-risk areas. We have a surgical safety focus, as do many of our own institutions on their own, as well as other groups throughout the state. Again, the goal here is, you know, the culture in the OR is just as important as the culture in an OB unit. And again, it needs to be a team approach to the management of the patient. We've heard a lot about checklists in the last 3 years. Checklists can be very effective. We're reducing the noise, if you will, around what needs to be done, and we make it easier for clinicians to succeed. And that's really the simple key to all of this, is really eliminating the failures, designing them out of the system, and allowing providers to succeed. As we all know, we've heard many times over, nobody comes to work wanting to harm a patient. But the system often fails the provider. And the goal of these collaboratives is to help hospitals build the capacity to ensure that the system can succeed. We have a number of other interventions in lots of different areas, including infection prevention and reduction. And we've seen great success with regard to central line-associated bloodstream infections by simply adopting a bundle of practices as you place a central line. Simple. But now if you do it across the board, you actually can really penetrate and see great success across the region. We have success with a C. difficile bundle that not only looks at how you treat the patient from an antibiotic standpoint, which is often the cause of this infection, but also how you simply clean a room after a patient who's had C. diff leaves the hospital. Some very simple things and some very complex things can have tremendous outcomes and benefits. Greater New York, as Art mentioned, was a great proponent of HAI reporting, public reporting of hospital-acquired infection rates. And the most recent report does demonstrate, I would say, significant improvement across the state and in many of the areas where not only Greater New York, but institutions and other associations have been spending a lot of their resources to derive improvement. We also believe that, again, to get a sustainability, we need to build a clinical infrastructure for the future, not just for today. We have a number of programs in the area of leadership. We have a critical care leadership network. And this is a group of intensivists that come together every other month and talk about what are you doing in your ICU that I can learn from? What's in the literature? What can we as a region do to really move the dime in terms of critical care? It's been an amazing group and a very unique and unprecedented type of communication that it is now created among both the EDs within an institution, the emergency rooms, and the intensive care units. And it also has led to a greater movement toward palliative care because of inappropriate, in some cases, use of ICU care and getting patients more quickly and appropriately out of the ICU. We have a Stop Sepsis Collaborative. I'm not going to go into all of these. I think I'll begin to bore you, and I don't want to do that. But I do want to get to the Clinical Quality Fellowship Program. Again, it's sustainability. We're looking at building the next generation of clinical quality leaders. And over the last 3 years, we've taken groups of physicians and actually provided them with education and training to really learn what does it take to implement a meaningful quality improvement program. And we've seen all of these fellows go back into their institutions and do tremendous work and actually leave their home institutions, be elevated into more senior positions, and become mentors to more junior staff. So it's been a very rewarding program, and I think a model that we should try to replicate in other parts of the state. I know upstate there's tremendous access issues with regards to quality improvement resources, and this is a way to sort of home grow, if you will, those resources that are needed internally. Using health information technology to create reliability in our systems, we know it's here now. It's not only the future, but again, it's a very resource-intensive demand, if you will, but one that hospitals are staying at. There are Medicare and Medicaid dollars to help support that, but there's a huge financial investment that an institution must make to get to the point of meaningful use. And we try to derive and to align all of our activities with public policy and public opportunities like incentive payments, and many of our collaboratives are met. The measurement comes through the meaningful use of the electronic record, so it's great synergy. In terms of responding to adverse events once they occur, for years, Greater New York has been at the core of root cause analysis training to really help institutions learn from their mistakes, if you will. They're not always mistakes, but learn from those non-preventable errors. How can we drive, again, design into the system a process that will keep the system from failing? And that's been a very meaningful endeavor for us. It's hard to say that it's completely successful because things still happen, but we are assured that institutions know how to take those lessons learned and create better ways of doing things. And in terms of staff communication, we've been really a strong proponent of disclosure and apology for many, many years, and we're delighted to be able to help the department with their ARC grant to really create a communication skill building program. It wasn't, you know, telling doctors you need to disclose certain things to patients, but really teaching them how to effectively communicate. And we hope to do more of that, not only with the department, but with our own members. We've done a lot with our members, but we'd like to do more. If you have stomach for it, I can tell you a little bit about what's next, because CMS is also very seriously committed to the whole world of quality improvement and has set really aggressive targets for improvement, looking to decrease preventable hospital-acquired conditions by 40% by the year 2013 and to reduce preventable readmissions by 20%. This is really a very aggressive but also a very meaningful template that they have set before us. They have committed $1 billion to do this, $500 million for community-based organizations to work with hospitals to improve transitions and another $500 billion for hospital engagement contractors, associations like Greater New York and others to come together and to really seriously focus significant dollars towards what they consider preventable events. I want to get right to what those are. In terms of the role of the HECS on slide 22, Greater New York, along with Haney's, and I'll get to that in a moment, has applied to become a hospital engagement contractor. We don't know if we will be awarded, but whether we're awarded such a contract, someone else will be focusing their efforts in this way towards New York hospitals, on New York hospitals. And the whole goal is to, again, take meaningful money and create programs that can create this sustainable improvements that we've enjoyed through our collaboratives and other very targeted approaches. The contract starts in October 2011, although the awards have not been made yet, and runs through 2013 with an option for a third year. I just want to show you the areas that they're focusing on are all the areas that we've been talking about today, obstetrical adverse events, surgical safety, infections, and other types of events that are deemed preventable in hospitals and that should never occur. There's also significant a significant focus on culture and leadership. So we are all kind of saying the same thing, which I think is a good thing because it shows that we're serious about really moving the dime, if you will. Our frustration with not being in a better place, in his estimation, from 1999 to today, I hope will be addressed by these efforts and that we see ourselves in a very different place a few years from now. I mentioned Haney's and Greater New York in terms of their partnership. We have applied as the New York State Partnership for Patients, and we believe that together these two organizations can take their many strengths and capabilities and really have a meaningful and significant impact on our hospitals. It's a voluntary effort by hospitals, but we do believe that our hospitals will be at the table with us. We will implement both a collaborative approach to some of these target areas, as well as a learning network and risk assessment approach. So much can be gained by identifying upfront the kinds of risks that a patient presents on admission, and if you get in early enough to prevent that adverse event, you're that much further ahead, obviously. I think the role of Greater New York has been defined. It does require participation by the hospitals in a very formal way. It requires that we report measurement data to CMS on performance as well as improvement. Again, we are waiting breathlessly to see if we are awarded and hope that we are. We've received significant support from the Department of Health. And, in fact, this might help deliver, to a certain extent, the quality improvement initiatives that the state itself needs to deliver under the most recent legislation. So we're looking forward to working with the department. And all of you, in all of our collaboratives, we always involve the specialty societies that we feel are the subject matter experts, whether it's ACOG or the surgical specialty groups. There's no one that we don't want to learn from as we move on this journey to quality improvement. So we're serious about it. I know it might sound a little bit like pie in the sky at times, but we believe that we have seen already meaningful improvement, and we believe just changing the paradigm in hospitals that things can improve and can be sustained is truly important and continues to be our mission.
Thank you, Ryan. That was an excellent presentation and does give a depth of the commitment. Any questions of Lorraine? Yes.
My question is this, and I personally, I'm coming from a background where words have really do mean something. How did this term medical error somehow get substituted into the lexicon for complication or adverse event? Not all errors are errors. Adverse events are not necessarily errors. Some are mishaps, but not necessarily somebody's error. And I think the word error has a certain connotation that we all ought to take a hard look at before we start putting things into print. That's just my personal bias.
Lorraine, do you have a comment?
You won't get any argument from me on that. The Department of Health has recently been passed that changed some of the language in the NYPORT's incident reporting program to adverse events. Adverse events includes medical errors and other types of adverse events that are not anticipated, are often unexpected, but are not always preventable. So I can't agree with you more that the term medical error is not synonymous with a lot of what we're talking about today.
Okay, and Fred, I guess you were better up.
Quick comment. This is a terrific presentation.
just fabulous. Really is. And if you're about changing culture, you're obviously walking the walk. Quick question, can we get a copy of the slides?
Yes.
I
actually have a
slide. Thank you.
All of this will be on the website.
Yeah. Thank you.
Nick and then John. Right now, I would echo Fred's comments about the presentation. And I also hope that what comes to fruition is your belief that the implementation of safety programs will, in fact, bear positive results in terms of reducing preventable adverse outcomes. When, for example, though, do you expect to get enough information akin to what New York Presbyterian reported as a result of these programs that your organization has implemented?
We, again, this is a voluntary program that we strongly endorse and implement as far as we can with our hospitals, but that is our next step. You know the tale with regard to obstetrical claims and statute of limitations and, when those claims can come to fruition. Part of our approach includes that risk management element that we implore the hospitals to align the quality improvement efforts with your risk management strategies and begin to document and measure. Whether we will do that for them remains to be seen. I think we're 3.5 years into this. We should be able to start documenting, sustainable and measurable decreases in certain categories of events, specifically related to the kinds of injuries that are, at the tip of the iceberg with regard to obstetrical malpractice.
You mentioned one concern, though, is that these are just recommendations and not something that can be forced upon a hospital. Is there any way to create an incentive for them to adopt it as opposed to just voluntary?
I think the incentives are coming in the form of public policy, but I also think CMS's effort through the Partnership for Patients and its targeted focus on obstetrical adverse events will create greater adoption across the state. We've seen great penetration in our region where we're sort of the missionaries, if you will, on this issue. But we will see more of that. I do believe we will. I can't tell you on the claim side, what a point in time.
What I saw from the New York Presbyterian experience was that they brought in independent evaluators, in other words, people outside the system to evaluate.
Mm-hmm.
To what extent is your organization doing that?
We have been brought in independent evaluators. But we have a medical record. We have a process for measurement that the hospitals are currently engaged in when they're looking at adverse events and then aligning them with the recommended process measures and identifying, is there a gap? Was there a failure to implement a process measure that may have been related in some way to an outcome? So as part of quality improvement, hospitals are doing that on their own. We don't have an independent outside auditor.
I think John has one question, then we'll move to the last person.
Somewhat overlapping to what Nick was saying, but again, you had on one of your screens a list of, I believe, 11 different preventable adverse events. First of all, for the caller on the phone, I think we're speaking about preventable adverse events as opposed to just otherwise adverse events. I assume when you make your recommendations to your member hospitals, you're anticipating that there will be savings both to the medical malpractice costs and then in turn to the Medicaid system costs. Do you have any estimate as to what savings there would be on both those categories, the medical malpractice system and the Medicaid system, if your member hospitals implemented these measures?
On the Medicaid side at this point, it's called a code suppression policy whereby the DRG cannot be increased to a higher level of payment if a complication occurs during that hospitalization. So in essence, the hospital will not get paid the difference between the higher DRG because of the complication or the admitting diagnosis DRG. So it's cutting into the reimbursement level. So I think it's small but will grow in terms of ultimate cost savings to Medicaid as more and more preventable conditions are added to that list.
But I think, Lorraine, we don't have an aggregate estimate.
We don't have an estimate at this point.
And then I guess perhaps a follow-up question. I'm not sure if Michelle is on the phone anymore or if there's any way of designing a study to track that and follow that to see exactly what savings are instituted. Is that something they do?
If somebody else can ask you to think about that.
All right.
Sure.
Joel Glass, please.
We're making it sound really simple, but it isn't. And it requires a change in culture. Changes in culture take a long time to actually accomplish. We have done the same as New York Cornell has done in obstetrics, probably more. And yet the best we've seen is sort of holding our own and a flattening of the frequency and severity of OB cases. But more importantly, the hospitals that are highest risk with malpractice problems, who are borderline financial, they can't afford the training and the controls and to follow the recommendations that are being made. It's tremendously costly just to train, just to do team training in surgery. We have to shut down operating rooms. That's a huge loss in revenue. And you can't just do it once. Team training, for instance, is ineffective if it's a one-shot thing. So if we're going to be serious about putting these reforms into place, we need financial aid to the hospitals to be able to really implement these things. Without that, we're just going to keep going on and on and make slow, incremental changes over the years.
Your point is well taken, particularly for safety net institutions. Which,
Joel, do you know roughly how much that would be? Like, what kind of money are we talking about?
No. I don't want to give you a number off the top of my head, but it's a lot of money.
All right. Well, Lorraine, thank you very much for your presentation. You've given us a lot to think about. It seems to me that this is an area where there's a lot of agreement around this table on this issue, the issue of transparency and data collection. So, hopefully these things can be part of our recommendations, and including things that Joel mentioned, I think are things we probably could all support. The last presenter for the day is Dr. Andrew Kleiman, who took time away from his practice to come here speaking on behalf of the Medical Society of the State of New York. And thank you for your time.
Thank you very much for inviting me, and hopefully my presentation won't be too long, but I'm going to give you a little different perspective and a little more personal perspective and something that doesn't have numbers. First of all, taking a look at the agenda, this is Medical Malpractice Work Group, and also it's a question of what are the practices being undertaken to reduce adverse outcomes, and also what's the impact on malpractice costs. And I do want to address that. We take safety very seriously. I'm treasurer of MISNI, but I'm also president of the New York State Society of Plastic Surgeons. And the American Society of Plastic Surgeons has really taken the lead in a number of things. And in fact, yesterday, when I was just kind of preparing for this, I printed out my CMEs, my continuing medical education credits. And in fact, right now, we have a separate column for patient safety credits. We are required during a cycle to have at least 20 hours of patient safety. In addition, we have created multiple programs that are solely directed at safety. There's an interactive Pathways to Prevention guide. Now, these are not so much to prevent malpractice risk. These are to improve patient outcomes. This is safety. This is patient safety. This is not malpractice. So basically, when a lot of people are discussing it, the line is truly blurred. And I think this whole aspect of the zero, the never events, you're never going to get some of those complications down to zero. You can't possibly. A lot of them are not occurring because of anything inherent in the hospital situation or anything that the physician has done. Patients get old. Patients get sick. When they're in the hospital, some of these things do come out a little bit more. So although they're being classified as all preventable, I would contend that a certain percentage of them are preventable, and not all of them are. Now, the question becomes, is the malpractice system a good system to kind of take care of this? Well, let me just tell you my personal experience. I've been in practice 26 years in plastic surgery. I was named in one lawsuit in 26 years, and that was by a patient who I had never met. I was named because when they looked at the hospital, when they got the hospital records, I happened to be the plastic surgeon on call. It was a case that had clearly no merit, that the first time it went before a judge, it was dismissed with prejudice, which is a term I didn't know till that time. When I actually spoke to the attorney who was taking care of it, and he kind of saw the details of it, he laughed. He said, don't worry about this. This is clearly going nowhere. Well, clearly going nowhere, he told me don't lose any sleep over it. I lost sleep over it, trust me. Even though it was something that clearly had no merit, not only did I lose sleep over it, but I also examined what I did in my own practice. And basically, I changed some of the things I was doing. At the time, my daughter was in high school and planning to go to college, and I was trying to save some money for that. And I took a look at what was going on, and I realized that any lawsuit could jeopardize that. So I changed what I did on a couple of things. In my hospital, we had 7 plastic surgeons. However, I was the one who had the best training in craniofacial trauma. So when the neurosurgeon saw a patient in the emergency room, even though there were 7 plastic surgeons taking call, they always called me. I was taking call 365 days a year for the toughest trauma cases in the hospital. It ended. I decided I cannot risk my family's future because of that. So what happened after that is whoever was on call would get the case, whether or not they had the best training in it or not. I think in terms of, and now I don't take emergency room call at all, again, because of the liability risk. I love doing those cases. I was making not a lot of money on it, a little bit of money, didn't make any difference. They were really fun cases to do. I no longer do those cases because of the risk. I was assuming in those cases essentially the same risk that the neurosurgeons have and pay a lot more malpractice than I do. I wasn't doing them as frequently, neurosurgical cases as frequently, but I was doing them plenty. In addition, in terms of one of the things that has been talked about is what's the cost of defensive medicine? It's virtually impossible to measure. I was in my hospital the busiest hand surgeon 20 years ago. Plastic surgeons, as some of you may know, are all trained in hand surgery, and when I took a look at the operating room statistics, I was doing 80% of the hand cases in my hospital. When somebody came to me with a carpal tunnel, clearly over 90% of the time, based on the history, based on my clinical examination, I knew whether or not the patient had it and whether or not surgery was the best thing for this patient. However, in spite of the fact that I could make the decision on clinical grounds, I always sent a patient for nerve conduction studies to get that piece of paper documenting what I had already found on physical exam. The physical exam, I felt, would not protect me enough in a malpractice suit, just in case something happened to the patient where there was an adverse outcome. How do you measure that? Well, if I were surveyed, I would say that's the standard of care, so I was doing it on everybody. I was being paid $380 to do the surgery. The test, I was approached by one of the companies that sold the machine to do the nerve conduction studies. They showed that I could collect $700 or $800 to do the test to justify the $380 surgery. You know, there's something wrong with this picture. So I think the cost of defensive medicine is extremely hard to measure. A lot of people would say, well, that's a standard of care. You should get it on everybody. What happens if you make a mistake? Well, in 20 years of doing hand surgery, I never missed on a guess about how the nerve conduction studies were going to come out. And, you know, the cost of that was truly outrageous. In addition, what Art Levin was talking about in terms of getting a better reporting mechanism in New York State. I've been the chairman of the peer review committee of the County Medical Society. I'm now the vice chairman of the Committee on Physician Discipline of the Medical Society of the State of New York. And one of the problems we have is when things happen that probably would be nice to essentially collate and to see where there are problems that we can fix, nobody wants to do it because of the fear of being sued. So therefore, my contention is that the tort system, in terms of the things that I've seen, have actually lowered the potential quality of medical care in many cases, not increased it. So I think the cost, when we take a look at all the costs of it, I think we have to take a look not only at the cost that MilMic can come up with, but also the cost of people not willing to do procedures that they're otherwise more than capable of doing, the cost of defensive medicine, the cost of people retiring early. My roommate from MIT, I went to MIT as an undergraduate, developed a company on the side, aside from his practice, that he eventually sold to Cisco for many, many millions of dollars. He was a neurologist. He retired at age 45 because of the fear of being sued and having all those millions of dollars at risk. So I contend that some sort of reform is truly needed, and I think that the savings would be far more than any of us would guess.
Thank you, Dr. Kleinman.
We're all deciding which one of us wants to trade places with your friend who made the millions of dollars had to retire. Hang on, we'll be back to you in a minute. Hang on.
First of all, when you have this kind of hand surgery, is nerve conduction study the standard of care or not?
There's not a true standard of care published or hadn't been for many years. Now, actually, in terms of New York State looking at it for workers' comp, they're kind of making it the standard of care.
But it's a test
that actually is substituting for clinical judgment.
But you were able to, in your clinical judgment, anticipate what the result would be every time.
Yes. There are always, there were a handful of cases that I didn't know, but I said I really need to get this test because there could be something going on. But of the people who I was pretty sure of the outcome, I was 100% accurate on those patients.
Well, what about other doctors, though? Would they be as accurate as you are?
That I don't know.
Well, therefore, that's why we have standards of care, correct?
Yes, that's why you have standards of care. However, in the case of people with training in hand surgery, I would contend the number of misses on that would be so low as to be insignificant.
I have one more question. In the case in which you were named as a defendant and were sued, and you said it was dismissed because it was frivolous, was that the entire case or just the claim against you?
No, the entire case was dismissed.
The entire case was dismissed?
Yeah.
I mean, one of the things that maybe Judge McKeon could comment on is how judges in the court system are pretty good at removing the cases from the system that shouldn't be there. It's one of the functions of a judge, and their training is to play that role. So I don't know if Judge McKeon wants to comment on that at all.
You're right, Mr. Chairman, and I for one, when we talk about judge-directed negotiation, it's more than just getting compensation for victims of malpractice. For me, it's just as important to get doctors wrongly sued out of these cases as soon as possible. And one of the real great disgraces, it seems to me, and I'm not referring to anybody in this room, they're the highest of the high, there are lawyers who can sue 20 doctors in a lawsuit, and when you ask them what they did wrong, they virtually give you the same bill of particulars, think nothing wrong of doing that. And there are ways that we can change the law in New York to permit somebody to find out what a doctor's role was in the care and treatment of a patient without naming that physician in a lawsuit and putting that stigma and the emotional consequences that flow from that on a doctor. It's easy to be done if we, and it's an area I think that there's some common ground. I don't think the top lawyers in malpractice in this town want to wrongly sue doctors or see people named who shouldn't be named. And so that's an area I think we can work on, and I think it's a very significant area, because what Dr. Kleinman is basically saying, and I've sensed it when I've spoken before medical societies, and I'm sorry to say it, a lot of the doctors have lost faith in the judicial system. And we have to take some measures, I think, to at least make the playing field more even as it relates to being careful before we name somebody in a medical malpractice action.
Thank you, Judge. Any other questions?
Yes,
whether it's from the gentleman on the phone.
Hold on.
I have a couple comments.
Number one, thank you, Judge, for bringing that up. I was personally sued for a case in which I made the correct diagnosis. I kid you not. And it took several years and a formal deposition before I was released from the case. I kid you not. True story. And thank you very much, Dr. Kleinman, for putting a human face on the issue of defensive medicine. I would like to remind the group that it's not just the dollar cost that defensive medicine results in. Dr. Kleinman reflected on the cost to himself and his family and colleagues. But there are other costs involved to the patients. Specifically, I'll highlight two issues. One, CT scans done in the emergency room. Number two, cesarean sections. CT scans in the emergency room. I read a case yesterday where the same fellow, because of his drug-seeking behavior and because he used different aliases, went to several emergency rooms and in the space of a relatively short period of time received 12 abdominal CT scans. In other words, he received more radiation than some of the victims at Hiroshima received. In the United States, there are 72,000 CT scans done annually via the emergency room. I'm certain that most of these are indicated, but more than a few are not. 72 million, I should say. That is estimated to result in 29,000 increased number of cancers. So what we do potentially does put patients at risk. So it's not necessarily only putting taxpayer dollars at risk. We're putting patients at risk. The second issue are cesarean sections because, as you ask any obstetrician, they'll tell you, if I do a C-section, I'm a heck of a lot less likely to be sued should there be an untoward outcome than if I don't do the cesarean. In fact, the only time I get sued doing a section is if somebody claims I didn't do it fast enough. So what happens? Well, we have in the 1980s when we were decrying a cesarean rate of about 1 in 5, now in some hospitals, that rate is approaching one out of every two patients who walk in the door. That's staggering. We have reinvented abnormal placentation. We see a marked increase in placenta previas, and with that comes risk of placenta accreta or normal adherence in which many of the times the uterus is sacrificed because you have no choice because of the hemorrhage involved. We've reinvented ruptured uterus such that no one wants to put patients at risk for a trial of labor anymore. So that's another reason for the increase. And then entities which are listed in the textbook as being extremely rare, namely a type of ectopic pregnancy in which the implantation site is in the scar of a previous section. I personally have now seen four cases of something that's listed in the textbook as exceedingly rare. Why is that? Because of the increasing rate of cesareans. And finally, we're reinventing maternal death. Maternal death, which had been dropping for decades, is now back on the rise. While I cannot attribute all of this to the rising cesarean section rate, this obviously has to have a consequence. So, folks, defensive medicine, besides the cost factor, has other cost factors as well, the human cost. And I'll stop there.
Thank you.
I submitted my comments in full to the co-chairs for distribution.
That would be helpful. Thank you very much. John, you were?
Dr. Kleinman, John Bonina. You mentioned, as follow-up on Matt's point, that there were certain situations in which you might be paid $300 to $400 for a surgery, yet a medical equipment company was telling you that you get $800 for running what you were perceiving to be a relatively otherwise unnecessary EMG, right? Did I hear that correctly?
Yes, that's correct.
Now, not necessarily in your hands, but could you see a situation in which there might be perhaps a defensive medicine motivation for ordering that EMG, but there also could be an economic incentive? Not, and again, not in your hands, but in the hands of another physician, an economic incentive to ordering that unnecessary test.
That's another issue, I think, for a different day, not directly related to this. But yes, I mean, they were trying to kind of create that. The companies do that. However, especially when it becomes the standard of care, a lot of the standards of care have been essentially pushed based on economic interest. Well, one of the things about the infection, at the hospitals are kind of between a rock and a hard place, you know, nationally. In terms of infection rate in orthopedic surgery, it has been shown by some specialty orthopedic hospitals that when they do orthopedic surgery, they can reduce the infection rate considerably, 80 to 90%. However, there's a federal law that no longer permits those hospitals to be chartered anymore simply because of the potential harm it would do to the acute care hospitals losing that part of the business. So there are a lot of political considerations that unfortunately go into the discussion of safety. You know, my point is that we as physicians hold safety higher than anything. If I have an adverse outcome for my patient, whether I caused it or not, I don't sleep that night. You know, we went to medical school because we want to take care of patients. That's our goal. And that's a much stronger motivator for us to do the right thing for most of us than any malpractice case would be. So that's what we're doing. That's what my society is doing. In fact, I served with Art Levin on the Department of Health Task Force on office-based surgery, and we came up with a great law requiring people who did surgery in the office to be accredited by one of the accrediting bodies. It was a fantastic law, and in fact, one of those organizations, the Quad ASF, who's one of the three accrediting bodies, they do better data collection than any government entity I have ever seen. Every case essentially goes into their database. When we had those hearings, Jeff Keyes, who takes care of that for that organization, came. They had just pretty much started it, and they had just short of 1 million cases in their data bank. And they found that in offices that are accredited by them, they had one death from anesthesia out of 1 million patients. I mean, the statistics were phenomenal. And the way they did it was a very non-judgmental, non-discoverable way to do it, and they got great statistics. I wish we could all have statistics like that, because then we would identify where the problems were in terms of taking care of patients. And I contend that most of the time when we look, we find the problem isn't a question that somebody did something wrong. The problem is something has been done a certain way for a long time that isn't necessarily the best way. And that allows us to examine our practices. DVTs are the biggest problem we have now in plastic surgery. And we have a major task force every meeting I go to. That's a primary topic of conversation. Now, you know, we're doing everything we know. And the number of DVTs that are as a result of people doing the wrong thing is negligibly small. Doesn't matter. People still die from it. That's our concern. We want to make things safer. And I contend that the current system is not encouraging it.
Fred.
Kleinman, thank you very much for your comments. Very, very powerful and clear. Question of things that aren't necessary for the patient, and in this case, the Medicaid patient. Is there any appetite for amongst organized medical professionals for looking at that question and perhaps working with the state so that the state no longer regard those things as being medically necessary for the care of the patient? You identify this particular test in this instance, that requirement, that instance, things that the doctor doesn't respect but somehow have come to be associated with your diagnosis.
Yeah, actually, there's a best practices, you know, movement among the specialty societies, really, to take a look and to see with a given diagnosis what is the best way to take care of things. And, in fact, I was at a delegate to the AMA, and I was there when President Obama came, and basically one of his suggestions was that if there are guidelines from your specialty society and you follow the guidelines, that would essentially indemnify you from being sued for not getting a test where the guidelines said that the test wasn't necessary. we're not there yet. We're not even close, and the data collection, you know, still has to go on. As I said, I believe very strongly in data collection. I think that's going to be the key. I mean, I went to MIT. I'm into numbers. I'm into science. And when we examine the numbers, we can really see what it is. However, the current system discourages physicians from reporting things.
Nick, you're going to have the last question quickly.
I don't think anybody could take issue with Dr. statement that the overwhelming majority of physicians become physicians because of their desire to take care of those that need care. But the flip side of that is, what's your position in terms of, you know, statistics that show, I think, like 6% of the doctors being responsible for more than 50% of the medical liability payouts? I mean, that seems to put a big burden on the good doctors, a few bad doctors, making it tough for everyone, which doesn't seem right for the good doctors. And one of the complaints has been about the lack of discipline of these doctors who have these repeated claims that result in repeated payouts. And if we just take a Zello study about 3 out of 4 getting it right, you know, is there a sense in your organization about the need to better discipline the few that are making it difficult for the many?
I know Ed Amsler wants to answer this, but let me give a shot first, and then I'll turn it over to Ed. Two things. One, there are some physicians who get multiple malpractice. It's not because that they're bad physicians, but because of the nature of their practices. I basically did my training at really top medical centers around the country, and we were taking cases that nobody else would touch. And yes, the malpractice rate was higher because we were doing harder things where the outcomes were going to be not as good. In terms of disciplining physicians, I used to be the chairman of the peer review committee of my county medical society. And this is back when it was much more active. We got probably 20 or 30 letters a month. And we would take a look, and of the 20 or 30 letters a month, maybe one per month, we could identify this guy's an outlier and we should do something about it. Unfortunately, because of our fear of being sued, the only thing that we could do is put it in an envelope and mail it to the Department of Health, to OPMC. Now, of the ones that we sent up, ultimately all of them lost their licenses. Some of them right away, some of them later on. But basically, the peer review system is so broken in terms of physicians being able to take care of it. We eventually were told by our legal counsel we have to pretty much stop doing peer review because we couldn't afford the risk of doing it. So yes, there are some physicians who should lose their licenses, and I think the OPMC does its job. In some cases, it does it well. In some cases, it does it less well. But yes, certain people shouldn't be doing certain things. And I would like to kind of hand it over to Ed.
If I can, thank you. Thank you, Dr. Klein. I get frustrated a bit when we hear these statements like 6% of physicians cause 80 or 90% of losses. I mean, you know, it's illusory. I mean, as a panel here, we want to look at some real causes and some concern. I mean, the best denominator we've got for this is that severe injury causes litigation and malpractice. We all know that. I mean, you guys don't take little cases. You take big cases. Yeah, there are bad doctors. Yeah, there have been cases of malpractice. We've all seen that. But that isn't the common denominator cause of our problem. Take a look at OBs. I mean, are all doctors in Rochester, they practice so much better medicine than those in the Bronx or in Brooklyn? Is that why the rates are so different? That's not the situation. I mean, I think we got to start dealing with the facts. When you look at 6%, you look at the numbers, look at it over the period of time relative to the specialty, relative to the territory, then you're dealing with numbers that we can handle and that we, I think, as a committee should be dealing with in a responsible fashion. I mean, otherwise it's just rhetoric. You know, I think we're spinning our wheels when we start talking like this and cross-examining on these numbers. I think, you know, if we want numbers as to, you know, number of OBs who are sued over a period of time, I'll get you those numbers. We also know that OBs get sued far more frequently than pathologists, than pediatricians. You know that yourself. I mean, these are the facts that we should be dealing with as a committee.
Well, on that, would you comment?
There are going to be a small number of bad apples in any profession. Most hospitals and medical groups have ways of dealing with those, so that even if people don't lose their licenses, they lose the privileges required for them to do what they've been doing. But I want to second what Ed said. In some parts of the state, the odds are overwhelming that obstetrician will be sued sometime during their career. It's hard to believe every obstetrician is bad. The odds are extremely high for neurosurgeons. It's hard to believe every neurosurgeon is bad. When we see those sorts of numbers in those fields, something clearly isn't right.
Thank you. We've received a lot of information today, and I want to thank all the guests who have provided commentary and information to the members of the task force. Joe and I think we're impressed with the quality of all the remarks, the quality of the comments from the task force members, and I think everybody understands the challenge that lies ahead of us. The next meeting of this task force will be in Troy on October 27th. What time will it start? Starting a little earlier, right?
I think we started at 10 to try to accommodate some earlier escape schedules.
Excellent. And Laura, the subject area?
The areas are going to be the tort system, and hopefully, it's kind of bolstered my resolve to make sure that we get a little bit more of a discussion about the insurance aspect, perhaps invite some folks from Department of Financial Services in to talk a little bit more about their role in insurance rate setting.
That would be excellent. I would also like to say that Joe and I talked about this before, that if anybody in the public arena has suggestions or have any thoughts about areas that we should take a look at and find additional information, please submit them to either Joe or myself or to Laura. Or the website directly, and then we can process those. And I can guarantee you we will look at all of them. So I want to thank you for a very important day at the beginning of perhaps some very monumental work. Thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Nice to see you.
Yeah.
I'm going to send you a little stuff.
Okay, I'm going to turn you guys, on the phone loose. All right.
The leader has disconnected. The conference will be terminated in 2 minutes. The leader has turned lecture off, and your lines have been unmuted. The leader has disconnected. The conference will now end.